disciples of Yochanan, the disciples of the Pharisees, the Pushim, they fast quite a bit. That's an important part of their spiritual exercise. Your disciples, your Talmidim, just eat and drink. What kind of spiritual discipline is that?
He had the gift of hospitality.
Well, he had no place to lay his head, though. It's not usually what's meant by the gift of hospitality.
That was Martha.
So what is his answer to that question? It's a bit of a challenge. We don't know the tone in which it was asked necessarily, but certainly seems like a bit of a challenge.
But it clearly states that you don't fast when you're with a person, you fast when you're away.
Right, so then he gives a quick answer, a brief answer. He says that, you know, in a wedding, if the bridegroom is celebrating, that's not the time to fast.
Mm-hmm. But I don't get this replacing new ones with old ones or pouring more stuff into it.
Okay, let's just look at his brief answer first. He says, can you make the guests of the bridegroom fast while he's with them? Well, that's a rhetorical question. No, you wouldn't even try to make the guests of the wedding party to fast because that would be inappropriate. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days, they will fast. Right. Now, this is kind of a parable, too. In fact, it is a parable. He's comparing himself to a bridegroom. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that right now I am with my Talmidim. It would be inappropriate for them to fast. But I will be taken away, and then they will fast. Yes. So he doesn't condemn fasting. His response to this question is not, well, we don't believe in fasting. Right. Quite to the contrary.
Yeah.
He says, well, right now it's not appropriate, but there will be a time when they will fast. Mm-hmm. Eliana, could you turn to Ecclesiastes 3, perhaps? It's just such a wonderful and beautiful passage anyways. We might as well read it. But it happens to be relevant as well.
Which verses?
It's probably 1 through 8 or something.
Okay, yeah. There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time to war and a time to peace. For peace.
And of course, this is based on a famous song.
So this is the time to tear. So it's actually there was a time to put old wineskin things on the old wine on the new wineskin.
There is, but wait, we haven't gotten that far yet. Let's just think about this Ecclesiastes passage first. Qohelet 3. What is being stated here? Does the preacher come out, or the collector, whatever Qohelet means? Does he come out, or the proclaimer to the assembly, does he come out and say, war is wrong?
No.
What does he say?
There is a time for war.
There's a time for war and there's a time for peace. Mm-hmm. Does he say that, I don't know, it's wrong to do anything in particular in this passage?
No, there's a time for everything.
God has his appointed times, and in those times, we need to do those things.
Okay. And it's not just even God's appointed times in the sense of like Moedim or feasts. He's not even talking about that. He's just talking about suiting the action to the circumstance.
Right.
There's a time to love and a time to hate. When would be a time to love?
When you're with your family.
Okay, right, yeah. Very simple. When would be a time to hate?
When you're with Hamas.
Well, let me interpret that as when you're with Hamas in Hebrew, when you're around violence, when you're confronted with evil deeds.
Correct.
It's a time to hate those evil deeds.
Yeah.
When would be a time to throw stones?
when you're with Hamas.
Okay. When it's time to stone something.
Right. When would be a time to gather stones? When you want to build something. So this is very practical, earthy wisdom. Uh-huh. It's very spiritual at the same time, but it's very practical, and very linked to just everyday affairs. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with what follows in what Yeshua says. No one tears a patch from a new garment and sews it on an old one. So is this some sort of highfalutin intellectual talk here?
No.
What's he talking about?
It doesn't make any sense. You take another old garment, you tear that and put it on the old
one. So you sew things sometimes. Is that what you do when...
Not the new one.
When an old garment tears, do you take a new garment, rip it up, and use that for patches?
No, I either buy a new piece of material or I tear another old garment and...
Right, and back then they probably would not have bought a new piece of material to patch it with either. They would have just taken another old garment.
My mother, the dress of 1,000 patches.
Right.
Or take it from the hem because the color will match.
Now here's a profound and deep spiritual question. Why don't you rip up a new garment to patch an old one?
It doesn't make any sense.
Why not?
Because then you're ruining a new garment, and the old one isn't going to get any better.
Right.
But if it's cotton, it'll shrink. And the color is not going to match.
But what about if it's linen or flax? That's the problem.
I've never worked or heard about
In any event, this is just simple common sense, right?
Right.
Okay. So no one's going to do that. If he does, he will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. So he says exactly pretty much what you said. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. Now, most people today don't patch their clothes, but at least most of us remember patching clothes, so we can relate to that to some extent. But very, very few people today can relate to wine.
A wineskin?
Wine and wineskins. Some people can, but not many people. But in those days, it would have been the same thing as, like, you know, putting on your shoes or cooking dinner or something. It was something very common in the society. Using your cell phone, you know, whatever is very common for us today, this was as common for them
at the time. No, but if you pour wine into a glass,
mm-hmm.
and you only have a little bit left in the bottle, and you have to open another bottle, you wouldn't think about pouring that into the same glass and mixing the two wines.
Okay. Yeah, that's a different analogy, but similar in some ways. But what he says is that you wouldn't pour new wine into old wineskins. And everyone would know what he was talking about just as much as when he said, you don't rip up a new garment to patch an old one. Why wouldn't you pour new wine into old wineskins?
I have no idea.
Because
he explains
right here.
He does. What does he say? If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. So you'll waste both the wine and the wineskins, just like patching an old garment with a new one.
Why would they burst?
Because they only have
wine for men.
Right.
They only have enough giving them to women one time, not over and over.
Wine expands, so the wineskins have to be able to expand with it.
And the wineskins are made out of what?
Deer skins have already expanded.
Yeah.
What were they made out of?
Old wineskins.
Deer skin.
Well,
deer
I don't know if it's deer, but it's the skin of some animal.
Yeah, like an ibex or something.
That's why they're called wineskins.
So
right, but so when they're new, they do have given them the skin of an animal. But if they've already been stretched out, they don't have much given them anymore.
Yep.
So they'll burst because the pressure that's built up from the fermentation of the wine won't be contained. There's not enough strength to contain it. So everyone would have known this. It would have just been common sense in that day. And he explains that, of course, you know, you'd be foolish to do this. You'd ruin both the wine and the wineskins. Instead, new wine must be poured into new wineskins. Everyone understands that. Then he says something else. And no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for he says the old is better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relevance of that?
Fermented wine tastes better than unfermented wine?
Don't mix good wine.
Okay. So
wine is better than grape juice?
So in other words, it's worth doing it correctly. It's worth taking the time to let this process develop.
Okay.
It's worth going through the effort of getting new wineskins, letting the wine ferment over a period of time, just keeping it and so forth, because the old wine tastes better. All right. Does this relate to the question that was being asked above, or is this just thrown in haphazardly into the text? The question again was that some disciples of other people fast a lot, but Yeshua's disciples don't fast.
Maybe he was just trying to make a point that there's an order to things. Mm-hmm. There's a proper way of doing things, and there's a proper order to things.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a good point.
Right.
Plus, he tells him he's the bridegroom.
Mm-hmm.
And the bridegroom was synonymous with the Messiah. They knew that the bridegroom would be the person that everybody's waiting for.
Right. Okay. But that's not really even the question here. It's just, why don't his disciples fast? The first parable he told them with the bridegroom says basically because it's not appropriate to do so right now. Mm-hmm. Is this? Do you think this next parable about the wineskins is also related, or is it should it be a new chapter or something? Should it have a new subtitle?
See, that you can't tell. You have to kind of look at the whole context.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a matter of interpretation.
Yeah.
Does it seem to be related to you?
No.
No, why not?
Because he was talking about the bridegroom and fasting, and then he explained that, and then they would fast, and then he starts in on a new topic about garments that are old and new.
Okay.
I think it's appropriate because he's talking about there's a time and an order for things. So,
right.
just like it's not time, it's not the right time for them to fast because the bridegroom's with him. He's also saying there's an order to things, and it's just like you wouldn't do this with a garment, you wouldn't do this with a wineskin.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think he's talking about what's appropriate. Still, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's appropriate to pour new wine into a certain container. But which container? A new wineskin. It's appropriate to have old wine because old wine is better, but it will be in an older wineskin because it has gone through the process of expanding. So there is this element of time involved, but more especially just the common sense of what's appropriate when, of things matching the circumstance, of actions matching the situation. And I think it's a very gentle and just commonsensical response to the question of, why his disciples aren't fasting. Well, in every area of life, there are things that you do sometimes and not other times, because sometimes they're appropriate and other times they're not appropriate. Sometimes you pour wine into new wineskins, sometimes you don't, or old wineskins and so forth. So to me, it does seem to be related. Of course, that's an element of interpretation, but it does immediately follow this, and it does, again, seem to go along with the parable of the bridegroom and the whole idea of, you know, an Ecclesiastes 3 type sentiment here. Any questions just on that before we go to how Christian commentators have looked at it?
Seems to me that possibly he was switching topics when he went to the garments and wineskins thing.
Okay. Do you have some evidence to support that point of view?
No. It just seems plausible to me, but it would make more sense if there was some. Usually in the scriptures there's some explanation along with the parables.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, there isn't for these last two.
It's funny because when you are looking for the meaning of the parables, you try to go like by parts, you know. As we said before, who is the bridegroom and mm-hmm. everything. In this part, like you are, like I am wondering, okay, who is the new wine or. Or the old wine, or like the specific details about what does that mean,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's funny because sometimes when you are talking in that way, you don't necessarily have another meaning behind. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You are just simply giving an example.
Right. Exactly, yeah. It doesn't have to be... the new wine doesn't have to represent people of a certain kind, and the old wine doesn't have to represent people of another kind or something like that. Now, it's used as an illustration for some reason, but for what reason, we have to try to understand. Now, one evidence to counter Vicky's point that it's one piece of evidence to counter Vicky's point that it's a separate section, that he's going on to something new, is found if we do look at the context for all three places where this appears. Note that it appears in three different passages, mm-hmm. Luke 5, Matthew 9, Mark 2. Mm-hmm. Now, if it's its own separate thing, we could expect that in at least one case it would just appear separately, and that it would have its own explanation, because the parables usually have some sort of interpretation to help you understand them. Mm-hmm. But in every single place where it appears, all three of the places, it comes specifically associated with this question of John's disciples fasting and praying, then the guests of the bridegroom, and then this. So it does seem to be a unit, at least.
Well, but that's true of a lot of the material that's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Okay, but I think there's more variation sometimes, at least. You know, in other words, if it's a separate passage, it might be dropped out of one of them, uh-huh. for instance, or it might have insertions in between, mm-hmm. you know, what came immediately preceding in a different passage. But, you know, that's a valid point. It doesn't prove that they're one unit, but it suggests that, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. To me, it seems to be fairly straightforward when you just read it that way.
Well, how do you relate it directly to fasting?
Well, the question is, why aren't your disciples fasting? And his answer is, well, certain actions are appropriate sometimes and not appropriate other times. Fasting isn't appropriate right now. It will be appropriate at another time. Just like certain actions aren't appropriate at a wedding, like fasting.
Yeah, that one
he's you know, linked directly to fasting.
Yes, right.
But these examples are the same thing. You know, certain things aren't appropriate. When you've torn an old garment, you're not going to tear a new one. Instead, you're going to take an old one and patch it. When you have new wine, you're not going to pour it into old wineskins. Mm-hmm. To me, it seems straightforward, just as saying, you know, again, the same thing as Ecclesiastes 3. There's a time and a place for everything. There's a time and a place for fasting.
Mm-hmm. And then he closes it by saying the old is better.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that have to do with fasting? Is he saying fasting is better than not fasting?
Well, I don't know that he's saying that. I don't read it that way. I just read it as an example. I just read it as an illustration. I mean, when Scott gives an illustration talking about motorcycles, mm-hmm. he's using it to explain a certain mm-hmm. point that he wants to make. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that when he says that motorcycles are the greatest things in the world, that there's a direct correlation between that and the point he's trying to make, although with Scott usually there is. But it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, or it doesn't mean that the exhaust piece of the motorcycle that he's talking about in his story has a specific correlation to the question, which may have been, let's say, fasting.
Mm-hmm. You see, I interpreted it as too.
Can I just finish that for a second? So, like, the way I picture it, imagine Scott up there answering this question, you know. Why aren't you and your family fasting? You know, some other people around are fasting and praying for something. Why aren't you fasting? And so he tells a story about a motorcycle, you know. When the motorcycle is making this particular noise, then you have to hit, you know, you have to change this. When the motorcycle is making another noise, you have to change something else. In other words, different things are appropriate in different situations. That's the way I view this. I mean, you don't have to agree with me. That's just how it reads to me. But, okay, Herta wanted to say something, and I think Leslie's been waiting for a while, too.
See, I just saw it as to those are the rules and there are certain proper ways of handling stuff. Mm-hmm. And as he is explaining about the wineskins, it just as an afterthought comes to him, why would you do that anyway? Because you'd be mixing bad wine, good wine with mm-hmm. bad wine, and the old one is better anyway. So,
right.
I think it was just kind of finishing up, but the main thing was the wineskins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was going to say that I think that we lose a lot because this seems to be very particular to the culture, and we no longer patch things with a pile of old cloth in a corner, and we don't have wineskins.
She doesn't know you.
And
right.
To use it in that term, I mean, for wine, for example, you would have to put it in a wineskin and probably sit in some corner for 2 years to be really good. That would be your better wine. Your six-month wineskin mm-hmm. would probably be your everyday, oh, somebody's coming, it's the Shabbat or something like that. So that whole cultural aspect of things done appropriately and done in the right time, we may lose.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
like patching clothes, they may have had an annual springtime, they pull out the spring clothes and or where they're going to put it away. Before they put it away, they go through it and they patch what needs to be patched. And they may need to wash it at that time after it's been patched or before, because you're going to wear it for another season or you're going to hand it down to the next group of people who are smaller or younger than you.
mm-hmm.
So I think we lose some of the cultural aspect.
Okay. I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe Vicky's question goes in some ways back to our discussion of Matthew 21, where the parable the different players in the parable correspond specifically to people or groups that he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that necessarily has to be the case in a parable or a story told for illustration. But it is the case sometimes. So I see what you're saying. The question that if you think it does have to be the case, people would then ask, well, who are the guests of the bridegroom? Who is the bridegroom? Well, that one, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the disciples and Yeshua.
Yeah.
Then you would ask, well, what does the new garment represent? What does the old garment represent?
Yeah.
What does the new wine represent? What does the old wine
yeah.
represent?
Mm-hmm.
And so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, notice that there's no interpretation given of any of that. Usually if there's a parable that's referring to specific people or something, there's an interpretation given in some way. Like in Matthew 21, for example, it says that the chief priests and the Pharisees knew that he was talking about them. Or in other parables, it will say that his disciples came to him and said, please explain this parable to us because we don't understand it. And then he explains it to them.
Yeah.
Here, there isn't any explanation of that kind. Yes?
Maybe. I don't know. I was thinking that maybe what he was referring is like, okay, my disciples doesn't have to fast right now, but you are doing what is right. I mean, if you are fasting, it's fine. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Right.
And they are fine, too. I mean,
because they're doing what's appropriate as well in their situation.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. And if you were forced to make new wine and old wine correspond to different things, to me it seems like what it would be then related to fasting is that the new wine would probably be Yeshua's disciples with him now. The new wineskins would be the circumstances that they were in at that time. It's new, it's fresh, they're with him.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't left. The old wine would be, in, I guess, later time, with age, with time passing, when he was taken from them, that they would be fasting, and that would be appropriate for being in old wineskins, which would be their new situation, something like that. And so if you interpret it that way, he is saying that that will be better. And in fact, he does say this in another passage, that he has to go so that the Comforter can come, that in a sense it is better for him to go. He says he has to go also to prepare a place for you. So
mm-hmm.
other passages do imply that. Now, I don't know if I'm totally comfortable with making those one-to-one correspondences there with new wine and new wineskins and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
if I were forced to make some correspondence, that's what I would suggest. Whereas, let's go to traditional interpretations now. Whereas traditional interpretations do something that's completely unrelated to the context, but is motivated by other concerns. The traditional interpretation says that new wine is what?
Not as good.
Well,
sure,
wait.
The church, the goyim, I mean, the...
grace. Oh, the new, grace, the essentially.
Grace.
Grace or Christianity, right.
Yeah.
And old wine is what?
The law.
The law. Yeah. Why do they say that?
Because supposedly
right.
It's law.
Because they view law as being old and grace as being new. Uh-huh. That's not the biblical perspective, by the way. But in that system of Christian theology, law is old and grace is new. So here we have new wine and old wine. So they kind of jump at this and say, well, the old wine is the law. The new wine is grace. Who are the old wineskins?
The Jews.
The Jews, because God gave them the law. They were his old people. Who are the new wineskins?
The church.
The church, the Christians. Mm-hmm. Exactly. God gave them his grace. And so what this parable becomes is a statement of replacement theology.
Mm-hmm.
That you cannot put grace into the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You can't put something new into the old wineskins. You can't put what God is doing now with Christianity into those old Jews. That's a problem. It's a problem for many reasons. First of all, because it doesn't come from the text at all. The text isn't saying anything like that. Secondly, because it is stating things that contradict the context of Scripture as a whole. But thirdly, because it's not even internally consistent with what the parable says. Because then how do you reconcile what Yeshua says at the end? No one after drinking old wine wants the new, for he says the old is better. So let's just translate this into the Christianese. No one after drinking the old law wants the new grace, for he says the old law is better. That doesn't make sense in that Christian theology.
Well, it does in their view that the Jews are misguided and they have their priorities wrong and so on and so forth.
Well, that was what was invented to try to get out of the difficulty, as you see from these quotations from various theologians, that they say, well, what it means is that the Jews are being obstinate. They could never taste the new wine. But he doesn't say that. He doesn't say that the old wineskins, who are the Jews, don't want new wine. He says no one, like no person, after drinking old wine wants new because the old is better. So that you're right, that is what was used as kind of a loophole to get out of it, but it's still not consistent with what's being stated. There are various commentators quoted here, Adam Clark, both parables illustrate the incompatibility of the old and the new, of the life under the law of Moses and that under the grace, the gospel. And then he gives the explanation that you did for the old is better. It's mentioned that Clark's commentary is typical. Earl Ellis said the two parables illustrate the dichotomy between Christianity and traditional Judaism. To mix the new with the old will ruin both. Each has its place, but the new is more than the old revised. In the context of the pre-resurrection mission, the issue was fasting. Luke's readers doubtless applied the Savior's words to other issues. You can see that actually both of these commentators do view this set of parables as a single unit. Even in their interpretation, which doesn't mean they're correct, because we're saying they're incorrect about other things. But it's interesting that they do see the fasting question and the bridegroom and the patch and the wineskins as all sort of associated in some way. Now, we probably don't have to go over all the details in this chapter. I mean, we've discussed previously that it's not a biblical perspective to believe in a contradiction between the Torah and the New Covenant, or between Moshe and Yeshua. As Yeshua said, if you believed Moses, you would believe me.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't believe Moses, you can't believe me. So Yeshua was not saying that the problem with the Jews, he didn't put it that way, was that they believed Moses. Rather, if they did believe Moses, any Jews who did believe Moses would believe him, and many did. What he was saying is that the people who claimed to be experts in the law of Moses didn't really believe him. Mm-hmm. They didn't believe Moses. That was their main problem. If they had believed Moses, then they would believe Yeshua. Now, to skip ahead a little bit, we could move to pages 254 and 255, and this is the part about Ilarion that I alluded to previously. Ilarion was a very important church leader in Rus, or the area that's now Ukraine, in the 11th century, and he wrote a major sermon, or he apparently wrote a major sermon that sort of summed up the theological perspective of that society. And in his quotation, he very clearly states what was already the standard Christian interpretation, had been for centuries by his time. Men do not pour new wine, the teaching of grace, into old skins, those having become antiquated in Jewry. Otherwise, the skins will burst and the wine will spill out. So the old wineskins are the Jews, the new wine is grace, the new wineskins are the new Christian peoples. Again, this doesn't have anything to do with what the parable actually says, mm-hmm. or what the text actually says as it can be analyzed. So why do people promote this interpretation? Well, on page 255, I think this is true, commentator after commentator already knows that God has rejected the Jews and replaced them with the Christians. Everybody knows that. So it doesn't really matter what the text actually says. The text is only allowed to reaffirm what everybody already knows. The tradition demands that the text be interpreted to reaffirm what everybody knows.
That's chillingly like the Catholics.
And not only the Catholics, it's chillingly like all people, yeah. Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Why do these things persist like this? Why do interpretations that are false go on and on, even when they're supposedly founded on a text like the Bible, when the text doesn't say that?
Maybe because we tend to rely more in human comments than mm-hmm. on the text.
Right. Mm-hmm. We tend to rely on human authorities to tell us what's true. And it's the same thing we started this course with.
Yeah.
Aristotle mm-hmm. and how people looked at him as an authority. Remember that quote about mm-hmm. how one of the philosophers or investigators observing a medical experiment said, well, you've totally proven your point, so I would have to believe it if Aristotle hadn't said something to the contrary, essentially. Mm-hmm. There's this tendency to respect the human authorities and to follow that. The same thing with Copernicus himself. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that the data supported the system. The data didn't support the system. It was there for anyone to look at. No one wanted to challenge the system. And it was dangerous to do so. Our human attraction to our own traditions is so strong that we're willing to kill people if they challenge their traditions. And that's perhaps most of the whole story of human history, mm-hmm. In a certain way. Now, part of the rest of this chapter here is devoted to showing that Yeshua was not condemning fasting, mm-hmm. because some people think that due to the response. He was actually saying that the disciples would fast at a certain mm-hmm. point in time. And there are many other biblical examples of people fasting. Here we read about David, Jehoshaphat, Daniel, the people in Nineveh, Yehuda in Joel. One that's not mentioned here is, of course, Esther. The whole community fasted and prayed for 3 days before she went into the king to save her own people mm-hmm. at the risk mm-hmm. of her life. Yeshua fasted. Nevertheless, it was not appropriate for Yeshua's disciples to be fasting at that time because the liberator, the provider, the bridegroom was present with them. So fasting is a good thing when it's used for its purpose. Is it a good thing, for example, to fast your entire life?
No.
Why not?
Your life would be very short.
Exactly. So it's not always appropriate to fast. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. And there's an interesting explanation given here. Ultimately, the purpose of fasting is to bring near the presence and power of the kingdom of God, to seek God. Mm-hmm. That's the point of fasting, for usually for something specific. I suppose it doesn't have to be. But that presence and power was right there with them, because he, as both the king and the bridegroom, was there with them. They were witnessing before their own eyes the fulfillment of the purpose of fasting as presented in Isaiah 58. They were witnessing the fulfillment of why Yeshua came as prophetically presented in Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. So why is that a fulfillment of the purpose of fasting as presented in Isaiah 58? Does anyone have a Bible they could use to look at Isaiah 58 quickly?
Verses? Oh, verse 6?
Well, is this not the fast that I choose? Whichever verse starts that way.
Okay. To loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke.
That's exactly what Yeshua was doing. The power of God was there doing that. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, for them to fast would be to deny that they had already received what they would be fasting for, or that what they would be fasting for was there in their midst. Mm-hmm. It wasn't appropriate for them to be fasting. So in the context, Yeshua's response makes sense. He's addressing the question, looking at when it's appropriate to fast and when it's not, first of all, and then more broadly, when any action is appropriate and when any action is inappropriate. And he gives certain illustrations, patching garments, wineskins, and so forth. So I think this is a much better interpretation of the parable, to look at it, as always, in its biblical context rather than from the outside. But perhaps there are still some lingering issues or questions that we can consider.
Well, I liked it if he was comparing it to Israel, because he said that the old is better, so that was better.
But he doesn't say that, does he?
Oh, sorry.
That's not a biblical perspective either, is it?
No.
God doesn't show partiality. He doesn't treat everyone identically. He treats people differently according to the purposes for which he created them. But he doesn't show partiality, and he does not say that Israel is better. There are advantages to being part of Israel. And the advantages are so great, as Paul says, many in every respect, that the Goyim, the Gentiles, should notice them. They should notice that there are great advantages to being part of Israel. And so they should want, at the cost of whatever price, to obtain membership in that politeia, in that commonwealth, that gives them access to those advantages and those privileges. Just like the Roman centurion paid a great sum of money to gain his politeia, his citizenship, his membership in the commonwealth. Or just like other parables say, you know, the woman with the lamp, or the man who found a pearl of great price, these are compared to the kingdom of God, and that people would go out and do whatever was necessary to obtain it, because it bestowed such great advantages. So there are advantages, but it doesn't mean that Jews are better, so let's not start that false interpretation either.
So the parables mean nothing but what they actually say.
Well, they mean what they're illustrative of. They're designed not to just be nice stories, they are designed to tell a point, and we know that sometimes it's hard to understand what point is being told in a parable, because the disciples who were right there with Yeshua didn't always understand what he was talking about. Many times we read that they had to go back and ask him, what did you mean by telling that story? So they're not always easy to understand. The point isn't always easy to understand, but there is a point. It's almost as if you have Aesop's fables without the fable at the end. You know, without the moral at the end, I mean. If you read Aesop's fables, there's, you know, a story about the fox and the hare or the tortoise and the hare, or the, you know, these different animals. And then at the end, there's a pithy one-line statement of the point that it's illustrating, the commonsensical or moral or ethical point that's being illustrated. The parables are sort of like that, but sometimes they don't have that last line there to tell you exactly the point. You have to think about it a little bit. Yeah. So I guess that does, in a sense, leave the arena more open to wrong interpretations, but doesn't mean that any interpretation is valid, especially when you can clearly see that it's motivated by some other considerations. Okay, well, would anyone like to introduce any other comments on this chapter, or should we close for this week? Okay, then next time we'll be looking at chapter 21, A Choice Property.